are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 15th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dennis Lewicki on the magnificent fight celebrating the Winnipeg General Strike, which took place this day 100 years ago. Also on the program today, Alabama passes a total ban on abortion as a means to test Roe v. Wade. And the U.S. State Department evacuates all non-emergency personnel from our Iraqi embassy, supposedly over fears of an Iranian attack. Convenient. Meanwhile, out of the deep concern we have for what's going on in the Middle East, the U.S. has all but shut the door completely and totally on Syrian war refugees. And federal court, Trump's bid to stop the financial records subpoena from Congress looks like it is failing. Elizabeth Warren says no thanks to Fox. And Joe Biden says the Republican fever just needs a little bit of aspirin and everything will be fine. 16 million voters were removed from the voter rolls in the run-up to 2016. Donald Trump Jr. will provide limited testimony to the Senate Intel Committee as per a recently negotiated deal. And in Florida, you'll have multiple radio stations that will be playing a never-ending loop of Trump speeches over the next 16 months. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. We threatened to do it. We claimed we would do it, and we're going to be doing it. We're actually not just acknowledging the Winnipeg General Strike from 1919, specifically.
Oh, Canada.
Yes. But we're going to be talking today to the author of The Magnificent Fight on how that strike came about, its lessons that we can apply today. Important to have a sense of these things when opportunity strikes, no pun intended, in the near future, maybe in the distant future, who knows. Meanwhile, the 2020 elections are happening. Joe Biden is up in New Hampshire, and it's interesting. In this office, there has been a slight role reversal, whereas I, for an extended period of time, of course, have been on my blame the voters bailiwick for several years now. There are others in this office who have been on the other side of that. And now it feels a little bit like things have reversed.
I think I've charted a third way the whole time between your complete discrediting of the people and Jamie's blind faith in them.
What has yours been?
It's that I both respect and disrespect the electorate simultaneously in a way that synthesizes the contradictions in a way that's convenient depending on the argument I'm making at a particular time.
I
will say that you have mastered that that ability.
It's an ability called synthesis. You're too blindly ideologically committed to your resentments and emotional agita and Jamie's utopian visions. Ask me today, is there a poll that's bad for Bernie? The electorate's looking very bad. However, I have confidence in them in the long term, potentially.
That is what I've been saying about Joe Biden. My confidence in the electorate is rather limited. However, I do think, and look, I'm not even saying this from an ideological perspective. I mean, I feel like I have a decent understanding of partisan Democrats. And I just think that those partisan Democrats have a little more savvy than they used to, and have a little less patience than they used to, a little less desire for compromise. I don't know that the West Wing could succeed today in today's environment, the TV show. But here is Joe Biden saying something that I think many of you will find, in some ways, incredibly stunning. Because you are all aware of what has taken place over the past 3 years. And you are aware of what took place in the 8 years during the Obama-Biden administration. And also are aware of what happened from 2000 to 2008 during the George W. Bush administration. And so on and so on. This is such a shocking thing to hear. We will talk about the potential explanations for this, which range from medical conditions to deep cynicism. But here is Joe Biden at a place apparently that serves yogurt in New Hampshire by a yogurt sign, answering a question, suggesting that all you need to do is get rid of Donald Trump. And then magic happens, yeah, and Republicans turn okay. Here
he's like the Night King.
I just think there is a way, and the thing will fundamentally change things, is with Donald Trump out of the White House. Not a joke. You will see an epiphany occur among many of my Republican friends. And it's already beginning this year in the House now. You've seen people that, in fact, were not willing to vote for any Democratic initiative, even if they agreed with it, because they didn't want to be the odd person out of it. It wasn't going to pass. There's no sense in getting politically beaten for something that's not going to happen. Let me put it another way. If we can't change it, we're in trouble. This nation cannot function without generating consensus.
Okay, so there's two parts to this. The first part is Joe Biden claims that the Republicans are going to have an epiphany if Donald Trump gets out of office. If this sounds remarkably similar to the idea, let's say, that their fever will break, that makes sense, because that's exactly what Obama said about the Republican fever breaking. He said this back in 2012, right before his reelection. He argued, my expectation is if we can break this fever, we can invest in clean energy and energy inefficiency because it's not a partisan issue. He says that if he expects the gridlock to end after the election, if he can win the election, because then that after the election, now it turns out that the goal of beating Obama doesn't make much sense because I'm not running again, we can start getting some cooperation again. Now, maybe Joe Biden was asleep during those years,
Or,
as Paul Waldman writes in the Washington Post, maybe there's some type of blow to the head that took place. In fact, he writes, if Biden thinks it is, he says, though this is something all of us would like to believe is true, it just isn't. And if Biden thinks it is, we should check to see if he recently suffered some kind of blow to the head. And then he goes on to say, it's possible, of course, that Biden doesn't actually think that Republicans will be joining him in a spirit of openness and compromise. He may know what the reality is, but also believe that it's worthwhile to at least pretend some other future might be possible. And Waldman goes on to say, the only problem with that is there's no evidence. There's much to be gained from being seen as reasonable and moderate. Voters don't reward you for it. It doesn't get you any closer to achieving your policy goals. So what's the point? So either we have someone who is deluded or just posing in a really, really unhelpful way. Because I actually think it's not just what's the point. There's great detriment here. Because if Joe Biden is setting up this basically built-in excuse for the Republicans and why they are following Donald Trump in lockstep, how do you explain what happened in Alabama yesterday? How do you explain what Mitch McConnell has been doing for years? How do you explain the empty seat? How do you explain Mitch McConnell going on and saying, the best part of my career was looking Barack Obama in the eye and saying, you will not get that empty Supreme Court seat. This is really stunning. And it is my contention that the Democratic primary voters, this may have worked 10 years ago. But I find it very, very hard to believe that this is going to work with people today. How much delusion do you need about the Republican Party? And if he does believe this, like I say, if he doesn't believe it, he's just piss poor at trying to set up a political context in which he can get anything done. Right? Because, I mean, if you're just saying Republicans are fundamentally reasonable, they're just under the throes, the hypnosis of Donald Trump. And this is your political strategy. What happens when they say no to you as president? When you have already basically given them the imprimatur of being reasonable? Well, then I guess it's reasonable to deny you any Supreme Court picks. I guess it's reasonable to deny you any to sign off on your hearings for to staff your administration. I guess it's reasonable to not allow you to have any federal court picks. I mean, this is what he's doing is extremely dangerous. And that's assuming he thinks he knows what he's doing. He may also just believe this stuff. He may be so insulated from what's going on that he believes this stuff, which is even scarier. But I will remind you that when Barack Obama made that deal that extended the Bush tax cuts, when they capitulated to the Republicans, when they did not need to do any of it, you all remember the fiscal cliff. Well, there was no fiscal cliff. Those Bush tax cuts did not need to be negotiated because they had a sunset provision. They were going to go away on their own. And there was one person in the government who understood that, and it was Harry Reid, which is why he was so angry when Joe Biden essentially slid back into the Senate and made a side deal with Mitch McConnell to say, we're going to give you some of the, you keep the Bush tax cuts, and we will get what we would get anyways. Joe Biden, and you can see it in the second part of what he says, which is, if we can't do this, the country is in real trouble. Well, we haven't been doing it for years and years. There's a reason why Barack Obama, the best things that he did and the things that were so easily unwound were because they were all by executive action. And the reason why they were all by executive action is because we're already there. We've been there. So the question is, how do you respond to it? Do you continue to go back to the Republicans and expect them to be moderate when they haven't been and they have been successful in not being so? Or do you make them pay a price? And he is basically saying there's no price to be paid. I understand you just were under the hypnosis of Donald Trump. I mean, this is just absurd, and it is dangerous. And it is particularly dangerous at a time now where that judiciary, all of that scheming by Mitch McConnell has paid off. And Joe Biden is just basically saying, you're going to get a free pass, a free political pass. And and what's going to happen is, if he becomes president, they're going to take that pass and they're going to slam him over the head with it. He's going to find out it's a club. Really stupid. And frankly, I think Democratic voters are just going to be like, what Republican Party are you talking about? This is something that makes Joe Biden look incredibly out of touch.
Delusional.
Yeah, I hope that you're right. I mean, it is a nice bedtime story, right? Like, Trump is the Night King, and as soon as you kill him, his army of ghouls is just going to fall on the ground and play dead.
Exactly.
We'll see. I mean, we'll see if people are dumb enough to buy it. I feel like I have to defend myself for a second, though. I did not say that I do blame the electorate. I said if I were the type of person to blame the electorate.
It sounds like you're learning.
Yes, I would say that if you vote for Joe Biden in the 2020 primary, you deserve President Andrew Dice Clay in 2024.
There you go.
I like the use of the word if.
Yes. Everything is hypothetical. This is not hypothetical. JustCoffee.coop offers you 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. They are a fair trade. Not only do they give a fair rate to their farms, they don't abandon their farms. I had a chance to go out to Wisconsin a couple of months ago. I spoke to the folks there. When their farms have problems, they stand by them. Other roasters, whatnot, they will abandon the farm because they know they can go to the next one and get the coffee that they need. These guys stay with these farms. I mean, even if their coffee did not taste great, even if they didn't have multiple types of roasts and types of coffee, even if they didn't offer a Majority Report blend, ladies and gentlemen, this would be the place to buy your coffee. But all of what I just said was true. So justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get 10% off your order. It's always free shipping. And also, don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking about the magnificent fight, the 1919 Winnipeg general strike with Dennis Lewicki.
Mama said to me, your dad is leaving home today. I think he's gone to stay. We packed up all our bags and drove out to Winnipeg. Came fast and hard.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Dennis Lewicki, who has been involved in managing and facilitating social justice and development for almost 45 years, works with community groups, government agencies to address issues of poverty, homelessness, and discrimination, and author of Magnificent Fight, the Winnipeg General Strike. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Good to hear from you.
So we are, today is the 100th anniversary, is that correct?
Absolutely. May 15th, 1919, all the action started.
All right. Well, I mean, let's just start just briefly, and I want to circle back to this and tease it out more. But briefly, why is it important for us to remember this strike?
You know, I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist by training and activist by inclination. But I think that what history gives us is it's a prism through which we can see ourselves today. And the 1919 strike was a struggle for social justice, for human rights. So by looking back at it, I think we can see some of the dynamics in our own society, our own time, and how we're relating to them. So I think it's a useful tool. Of course, it's not a blueprint. We don't get a blueprint from history, but it helps us understand, and especially when we're doing anything that requires collective thinking, you know, it helps a group. For example, I do a lot of work with young people, high school students, and it doesn't take them long to draw the links between the past and the present, and then the discussions about the present. And I think that's where history, and especially the strike in our case, is really dynamic. It's a great resource.
All right, let's talk a little bit about, just so that folks get a sense of Winnipeg. It is a city now, I'd say probably about the size of like a Seattle.
About a million. About a million population.
Oh, a million. Okay. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what Winnipeg was like 100 years ago.
Winnipeg at one point was the third biggest city in Canada. And it actually was called the Chicago of the North because of the amount of grain that was traded through the grain exchange. So in both between 1900 and 1920, it was a booming place. I mean, the population grew from 40,000 in 1900 to almost 180,000 20 years later. And it was a real agricultural and industrial center. Three railroads converged here. There were 13 banks, the grain exchange, the industries, metalworking industries, huge steel production for the construction of big buildings. At one time, there were 13 what people call skyscrapers at the time, and one of them that was built in 1906 was considered the tallest building in the British Empire. So these are just indicators of an economy that was really, really growing fast and really involving a lot of new people. So a lot of those thousands of growth, they were immigrants. They were people coming from Britain, the United Kingdom, and Eastern Europe to work in the industries or to work in agriculture. So there was a huge influx of immigrants that really was changing not only the economic and labor relations situation, but was really affecting the cultural character of the time. So it was really a dynamic time. For most, it was an exciting time. For some, it was bringing about change that was a threat. So it was good in many ways, but it also created stresses and strains on the society at the time.
Okay, and so you mentioned that it was renowned for having a skyscraper. And yes, the strikes started, at least in part, with some of those construction workers. Tell us what led up to the strike.
Well, there were two real key groups at the time that were negotiating for better wages and reduced working hours. And that was people working in the construction trades, electricians, carpenters, that kind of skilled tradesmen. And then on the other side, there were the metal trades workers, tinsmiths, boilermakers. These two groups were negotiating with their employers at the time. And mainly it was around wages. But if you remember, at that time, it was 8 to 10 hour days and 6 day weeks. It was, you know, nothing like we have today. So they were always trying to negotiate better working conditions and benefits for workers. The employers were very resistant to that. And at that time, remember that the unions were not formally or legally recognized. So it was a very informal relationship between the unions and the employers. So on one hand, for example, in the construction trades, the contractors, the big construction companies that were building those buildings, they knew that they had to pay more. They agreed that workers were not getting paid much. There was a time when, during the First World War, when wages were in effect frozen as part of the national response to the war effort. So the employers in some cases knew there had to be improvements and increased wages, but there were disagreements over how much and when to apply these changes. So it was, a dynamic time, lots of construction, lots of work being done, but it was a situation where the workers were expecting more out of their labor at the time.
All right. And so so give us a sense of, it's interesting. So the dynamic, from almost a generic sense, is a situation where the workers are aware of just how much those owning these companies and presumably the growth of who are benefiting, the capitalists who are benefiting from the growth of the city, and this is building resentment. Walk us through who went on strike first, how this thing spread. But I'm also curious at this point, because in the States at this time, particularly 1919 in many respects, and certainly in 1920, there's a lot of rather, famous, like Matewan was in the States. I think it was maybe 1920. There was a lot of striking that was going around, particularly through the 19-teens, at least the earlier part. So how much were the unions in Canada? What was their relationship with the unions, or I should say, the workers in the States?
Good. I'm glad you brought that up, because prior to the strike, there was a lot of labor action in these states and in Europe. This was a global phenomenon where unions were organizing. In the 1880s and 1890s, a lot of the workers were organizing into unions, both in Canada and the United States. So they were really developing and testing their union muscle at the time. And there was resistance, obviously, from employers. They wanted to control wages and control workers. So it was a time when there were thousands of strikes. Even in Europe, going back to like 1906, 1907, Belgium, Spain, there were major, major strikes. The Russians, before they took power in 1917, they were using general strikes as a way of putting pressure on the government at the time. So, it was a pretty universal phenomenon. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned, Seattle in January of 1919 had a huge strike. 65,000 workers went off for a week. And it, in many ways, was a template for what happened here in Winnipeg. So just as you, to respond to your question about how it all got launched here, the metal trades and the construction trades workers were negotiating in March and April, not getting very far. So both of those went on strike on May 1st and May 2nd of 1919. That really was the catalyst. There was a strike. They were pushing for wages and reduced hours. They went on strike. That then got the Winnipeg Trades and Labor Council, which represented other unions in the city, to then call for a vote on whether or not they would support those workers on strike. Well, the response was overwhelming. 11,000 or around 8,000 members voted to go on a general strike. Only about 600 voted not to go on a general strike. So right from the beginning, you can see there was a lot of union solidarity and common interest, of course, at the time. That then brought out roughly another 12,000 workers or 18,000 workers. And as I said earlier, a population of about 180,000. So you had 10% of the population on strike on May the 15th, 1919, 100 years ago today. The other interesting fact or phenomenon was that within a few days, another 12,000 workers who were not unionized went on strike. They were immigrants, largely working in small businesses. Some of them, domestic servants, for example, in the homes of the city's rich, and they basically walked off their jobs as well. So that surprised everyone. But what it meant was that there was now 30,000 workers on strike in a city of 180,000. And just to add to another dimension, so we're talking numbers. The veterans who were coming back to Canada from the First World War, they saw, a lot of them saw common cause with the strikers. I mean, they wanted jobs. They wanted to be treated fairly. They had just sacrificed a lot in the name of democracy, and they really wanted to enjoy the fruits of that democracy. So about another 4,000 or 5,000 veterans got involved. So within a few days after May 15th, there was almost 35,000 workers on strike, and they carried through that labor action for 6 weeks.
And so, you're talking about almost 20% of the population, and I would imagine much higher figure relative to the working age population, right? Because we're I mean, and so that has devastating effects. I'm curious about this dynamic before we get to, you know, how this ends. And what happens over those 6 weeks. But the idea that you'd have 12,000 non-union workers join the union strikes, the idea that you had 4,000 to 5,000 veterans who are obviously, you know, sort of, I would imagine, they still have particularly close bonds, particularly at that time, having just come back from the war. So there's a tremendous amount of solidarity amongst the veterans. There is in this country now, and I imagine there's some maybe analog in Canada, although I, to be honest with you, I don't know, a movement amongst unions that are trying to turn away from the managerial unionism that has dominated the union movement over the past, I don't know, six decades. And move towards a more of a social justice unionism, which, you know, as in broad swaths, basically means that you as a union, you don't just fight for your own wages and your own job. You fight for issues. You create solidarity across society by picking up and fighting for the issues that are shared by folks in the working class and shared by folks across, you know, some amount of classes, the non-capitalist class. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
And so how much of what was the consciousness of how the approach was taking at that time? I mean, if the unions were able to mobilize 12,000 non-union workers, which is, you know, almost the same amount of unionized workers, maybe a little bit less, in total with the veterans, they were able to mobilize a significant amount of the population. Was that a function just of everyone having a shared resentment, or was there a plan to build cross, intra-union solidarity, or was it because they were immigrants, or what was that?
Well, there were a number of things, I would say. However, one of the key elements that kind of glued together that class solidarity was a lot of these immigrants came from situations in Europe where they had felt oppression. You know, they were living under draconian regimes, feudal regimes. So they came to Canada with a couple of expectations. One, they were coming to Canada to build a new country, to build a new nation. And it wasn't just their labor, it was their tenacity, their courage, their resilience that they knew they were bringing to Canada. Secondly, a lot of these organizations were very, very independent. These people were very, very independent. So they built their synagogues, they built their labor temples, they built their churches, they set up their community organizations, they started benevolent societies. You know, they were not waiting for government. I mean, there was no expectation that government would provide these services. So there was an ethic right from the beginning of people helping themselves, helping each other. And we can tell many stories of, you know, different ethnic groups that may have been fighting in Europe, but they came to Canada and started working together. There was a collaboration around issues. So I think that was a kind of a seminal part of the changes that were taking place. A lot of the social services prior to the 1920s were provided by church groups or by benevolent groups, many of the middle class. There was a sense of, you know, that it was important to help one's neighbor, to help the destitute. I remember there were a lot of widows created from the First World War, and they rarely had a good alternative income. So there were these women and children that needed support. And because we're kind of a smaller country than the States, and our cities were smaller at the time, there, you know, people knew and could see the conditions that people were living in, and there was that effort to respond. So one of the things that's maybe a little different between Canada and the States is that we've had a bit of that social unionism right from the early 1900s. And so we've pushed through, and whether directly initiated by the unions or initiated by the progressive political parties with the support of the unions, but we've got a lot of the, you know, socialized medicine, the improved educational services, unemployment insurance, and things like that, and that we've had for, you know, decades here. So it's a little different, but I'm really glad you mentioned this in terms of the unions responding to economic and cultural conditions today, and especially a lot of young people want to get involved in organizing around environmental issues and social issues, you know, confronting racism and things like that. And the unions are responding. They are getting on board and seeing that there is that sense of both obligation and benefit when we all work together around these issues.
So the strike ends 6 weeks later, more or less, at least officially, I guess, on what is known as Bloody Saturday. What happened on that day?
Yeah, that was, you know, it was a constructed, spontaneous conflict. The state, the local elite had been planning and trying to figure out ways of confronting the unions. They were ready for a fight. You know, they had special police hired, ready to intervene. They had military ready, so that when the veterans planned a silent march, a silent demonstration, on June the 21st, and it started out very, very peacefully. About 8,000 people congregated in front of City Hall in downtown Winnipeg, but the authorities were not up for tolerating any of that. They charged in with horses and clubs, and at one point they even pulled out their revolvers and killed two men. So it was a brutal suppression of the workers and of the veterans, and it was, like I say, they were very clear that it had to be a peaceful, violent protest. And they were protesting the arrest of 10 men that had been arrested just a few days earlier, and the raids that took place on three of the labor temples. Again, the state had no authority to make these raids and arrests, but they did, and the public was incensed. And so there were demonstrations all across Canada, and the one planned here in Winnipeg, you know, on June 21st was to culminate and really express the public's criticism of the government and what they had done with these men and with the labor temples.
And so what happened in the wake of Bloody Saturday?
Well, you know, the workers, I'm sure, you know, not being there, but, you know, from the records we had, the workers were obviously disillusioned by then, because it seemed that the strike had become very violent. Throughout these 6 weeks, the unions were constantly saying that the best thing that for the workers to do during the strike to win was to do nothing, not confront, not challenge, not demonstrate. So when this happened, it demoralized everyone, and the Central Strike Committee then called an end to the strike for June 25th. Now, in a way, the interesting echo or wave that came out of that, within the next 2 years, a number of very progressive and labor-oriented politicians were elected to office in the city government, the provincial government, and the federal government. And just to give you a snapshot, three of the so-called strike leaders that were charged with and convicted of seditious conspiracy, they were in jail in 1920 when they ran for the provincial legislature, and they were elected, overwhelmingly elected, even though they were never allowed out of jail. So, you know, the aftermath really was a vote of the people on the strike, and they voted their support for the strike and the strike leaders.
Wow. So following that, like, what were the echoes and the ripples of that strike?
Yes.
I mean, did we see any type of reforms? I'm curious if there was ever any analogous legislation. And, you know, I'm jumping ahead. Of course, Taft-Hartley happened in this country in the 40s, late 40s. And that ultimately, I think, has really undercut the power of unions. And, you know, I think people are working on trying to figure out ways in which to rebuild that union power. But it the worst thing about Taft-Hartley in terms of power is it really prevented general strikes and of this ilk. But was there anything equivalent to that in Canada? And to the extent that there was or wasn't, was there also any other sort of ripple effects of this strike?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, right after the strike in the 1920s, it was a period for the economy where there wasn't the same kind of growth that preceded the 1920s. So that was the first thing. And then by 1929-30, then there was the Depression that put a cap on a lot of economic development and change. So, you know, things that had kind of national dimensions to them that had nothing to do with the strike were really dominant at the time. However, the unions, it was a setback for the unions because workers were disappointed in the failure of the strike. And so there was a time when the unions had to build back their credibility and their strength. But the significant thing, one of the significant things that came out of the strike was that the living conditions that the workers had experienced and were experiencing was really exposed. And in Canada, we have something called Royal Commissions. That's when a government gets high-powered, credible people to do an investigation, to do an analysis of an important issue. And so in Canada, there was a federal Royal Commission and then a provincial Royal Commission to look into what were the underlying causes of the labor unrest and the Winnipeg strike. And both of these clearly pointed out that it was, you know, the workers were frustrated, they were unemployed, they were facing poor working conditions, wages were low. At the same time, there was a wealthy class that was benefiting from the labor of the workers. You know, so these commissions, and these are very, very elite, government-oriented commissions. Both of them were run by judges. Both of them came out and basically endorsed what the strikers were fighting for. So that didn't lead to immediate social service development, for example. But it did put in place, and it did show the importance of government and non-governmental agencies working to provide the kind of supports that workers needed, that you can't just expect workers to be slaves. They do have their personal lives. And by the 1940s and 50s, you saw an awareness that when workers are well clothed, well fed, educated, it benefits the economy, it benefits industry and business. So, you know, it took time, but the strike and the commissions that came out of that so clearly articulated the living conditions and the exploitation of workers that it did register for the future. I wouldn't say there are direct relations. I'd love to say that something that was done in, during the strike, you know, led to certain legislation, but there's very few links. I'll give you one example. One of the strike leaders, a guy named J.S. Woodsworth, became quite famous, and he really, really pushed the Canadian government to institute a pension plan for Canadians, which we now have, and it's a fairly healthy plan, and a lot of Canadians rely on it. Well, you know, he was a strike leader. He was in Parliament in the 1920s and 30s, and it took him a long time and other progressive politicians, but they were able to get something very significant that not only benefited unionists, but benefited everyone in the country, all citizens. So there wasn't direct relationships to what happened after, but you can see that there was that the strike was a catalyst in a way that allowed progressive politicians to then move forward and push for a more progressive agenda.
That, I think, is a huge lesson for folks to take from this story. And I have to say also, I'd be remiss if I didn't say the idea of those elite commissions resolving that the strikers were right sounds about the most Canadian thing I could ever imagine in some way. But Dennis Lewicki, the book is Magnificent Fight, the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Great to meet you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have fun. Ladies and gentlemen, we will have fun in a myriad of different ways. One of those ways will be to make fun of Dave Rubin again. He had on my old buddy, Mike Cernovich, on.
Oh, boy.
You remember Mike Cernovich. They're just exchanging ideas. You remember Mike Cernovich. He is the guy who is a documented date rape denier. He was also documented a promoter of Pizzagate, which ultimately led to a man going into a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. with a weapon, looking for hidden dungeons where there were pedophile and prostitution rings.
Don't forget, he's an alleged rapist, but he pled it down to battery, so.
That's true. That is also true. There's more, of course. He also was famous for stepping on a rake and getting hit in the face, or rather, I should say more specifically, trying to get me fired and not getting me fired, or getting me fired and then having that not work out for him. He accused Barack Obama of all sorts of things, obviously, and he also failed miserably on his on-air screen test on InfoWars, which was difficult for him. Also a professional, what do they call him, pickup artist? Wasn't he basically was telling people to how to neg women. Basically, you know, that's the way you pick up the ladies, I guess. But so Dave Rubin had him on for a second time. And I think, look, Dave Rubin can have on whoever he wants, and he can obviously not have on whomever he wants. But it seems to me there should be some accounting for platforming a guy like that. And they talked about some of the stuff, of course, the massive amounts of pedophile rings that he is convinced happened. But as far as I know, Dave did not bring up the widely publicized attempt to get me fired. They did complain, however, about how hard it is and how online culture is so despicable. In fact, do we have that clip? Let's play that now. There was a... here is... this is clip number 5, right? Is that it? Or is that the best one? I think so. Oh, yeah. Okay, so let's play a compilation from the actual filmmaker, Vic Berger, as opposed to the fake filmmaker that is Mike Cernovich. And here he is doing his rendition of the talk between Dave Rubin and Mike Cernovich, wherein Mike Cernovich really is upset. I will remind you that Mike Cernovich claims to have paid someone to dig through my tweets. They found a tweet from 2009 where I satirically chastised those people who were being apologists for Roman Polanski as a rapist, wherein I wrote in response to a petition that was going around in Hollywood trying to get Roman Polanski, get him some type of lifetime achievement award or something to that effect, wherein I wrote... regarding Polanski, don't care about him, but if my daughter is ever raped, I hope it's by a much older man with a great sense of mise-en-scene. And the satire there obviously was that it is absurd that you would let someone off for the rape of an underage girl because they're a great filmmaker. That seems absurd. Well, of course, Mike Cernovich hired someone to dig through my tweets. That's all they could find. They tried to weaponize that with the use of bots. They had Donald Trump Jr. retweet it. They had Seb Gorka retweet it. Mike Cernovich and his folks pretended to be outraged citizens, members of a... pedophile victims group and emailed all of our advertisers in an attempt to get them to end their association with this program and ultimately got me fired from MSNBC. And then ultimately I was rehired. That did not come up in this conversation, but what did come up is how hard being a public figure is for Mike Cernovich, as told through this Vic Berger video.
Vic Berger did, you know, he had...
Shh.
All right, I think we're live. We're live? We're live. Mike Cernovich, how you doing, man?
I think about every day how I ruined my life by ever becoming a public figure. And I could just write my books and live a good life, and nobody knew who I was. And before Trump ran, I was... in a Parisian cafe, just writing, having fun with my wife, walking around looking at Notre Dame before it burned down and everything. And every day, I think I ruined my life by becoming a public figure because just the fundamental indecency of it all is not something that I was prepared for. I'm prepared for a hit. But the angry little weird left people, the freaks, the weird Mike, and the people who support my family being harassed, they'll do all the dunking on Twitter. That does make you, in a way, it makes you sad. And the problem with making people like me sad is sometimes I hold my daughter and I think about the people who are trying to hurt her.
I remember we went to some party because my buddy's girlfriend said that this guy raped her. Mm-hmm. And we go, let's go kill him.
Right. You all know what Vic Berger did. You know he edited fake videos about my wife and daughter. Fact. You know that he's edited multiple videos about my daughter. Fact.
And we're back. Sorry, my child's trying to be in this, but this isn't really a kid-friendly.
Yes, these are all real. So just ask them, what did they mean by that? And you know the emails he sent me, the threats. You know that I've gone to police. You've seen the police reports. So
he
talk
calls,
about
this is some clown. He's a verified
this is some clown,
clown
but they're
he
watching.
Calls, he calls me all right. And
yeah, this is my message to them. He made fake videos about my wife and daughter.
This could be an actual pedophile ring. So I have to just make it public and publicize it. They're all connected to this guy. His Twitter handle is VICBERGER4. Please, vet, call the cops. Again, they're all connected to this one guy. He's at the middle of all, Vic Berger. Fuck you, sue me. You know, like, I just don't give a fuck.
All right, man. Well, on that note, I hope we cleaned up some of this. The chips will fall where they may, and we'll both keep going, I suppose. And
my pleasure. Thanks
yeah.
again.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Yes. There it is, folks. And apparently Dave Rubin now wants to host Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. Mm. And boy, it seems to me that would be a huge mistake for that Democratic primary hopeful to appear in that same very seat where but if he wants to be seen in the same light as someone like Mike Cernovich, I mean, I'm not, you know, I have no bone to pick with Mayor Pete. He's not necessarily my favorite candidate.
I have plenty.
But if that's what he wants to do, then I say more power to you. I hope that that brings you dividends. I just have a feeling it won't bring you the dividends you think it will. If you are a fan of Mayor Pete's, I would suggest to him probably not a good idea. But, you know, like I say, to each their own. And again, I want to remind you what Mike answered the question, the eternal question of Mike Cernovich. Who's laughing now, Sam? It's me. I'm laughing now. Ha ha. Ha ha. Ha ha. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, you can become a member of this program. In fact, you can still become a member of the Mike Cernovich Can Kiss My Ass tier, a membership tier on Majority Report. Head to jointhemajorityreport.com. Just pennies a day. You can support this program. You get extra content. You get a commercial free. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Today is Wednesday, May 15th. That means that yesterday was Tuesday, May 14th. What happened last night in this office, Michael?
We had a mini illicit history of the Iranian Revolution and how that government works. Then Emma Vigeland joined us, and we talked about everything from the Knicks and the NBA draft, which means quite a lot to Emma. I did not know
she's
her
a huge
expertise.
Knicks fan, right?
I knew she was, but I didn't like. It's not just the fandom. It's like I think Bhaskar Sunkara is the only other like Knicks dedicated head that I've ever met. Like Waz doesn't care about that. But so we talked about that. We had a Game of Thrones segment, which I'm pretty sure will never happen again on the show, and talked about the many, 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 many ways that Joe Biden is very bad for you and not good, and of course a whole bunch of other stuff. You can get the whole thing at patreon.com/TMBS, and also for patrons, you can get your pre-ordered tickets to our Chicago live show in August and Michael Brooks Show on YouTube and everywhere else.
Jamie?
So this week on the Antifada, we took a turn for the erudite after talking about butt stuff in the Star Report with Katie Halper last week. And we spoke with Samuel Stein, not the one from HuffPost, the Marxist geographer, author of Capital City, Gentrification, and the Real Estate State, which is out now from Verso Books. And we basically talked all about the global housing crisis, where it comes from, why the economy is so reliant on real estate at this point in time, how even well-meaning progressive politicians and planners are ultimately constrained by the system, and how we might ultimately unite and slay the housing monster. So check it out.
Check it out, folks. Check out Hiawatha Talk on Matt's podcast, Literary Hangover. Quick break, fun half. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.